This podcast is brought to you by bellacatering.com.au. Guys, the folks at Bella Catering are one of the best catering companies in the whole of Australia, and especially in Sydney. But due to the coronavirus restrictions, those lovely folks led by Glenn and Maria are unfortunately struggling. But we can help them, and I want to help them with this show. So if you guys can and you like delicious things and you're in Australia and you're in Sydney and you're within about a 20K to 30K radius, which is pretty much the entire Sydney basin, if you want delicious food at a great price and you want it delivered to your house, bellacatering.com.au is where you need to go. Absolutely delicious stuff, family stuff, like, you know, huge get-togethers that we're doing virtually and things like that. You want leftovers, you want that sort of thing, bam, bellacatering.com.au. Glenn is absolutely a deeply questionable individual. However, that should not be held against him. He has a lovely wife, he has a lovely family, and they've got great staff, and they are awesome. Now, onto the show. The Watergate scandal had reached a peak, and President Richard M. Nixon was furious about press leaks. His suspicions focused on a number two man at the FBI, W. Mark Felt, a 31-year-old Bureau veteran. He ordered his aides to confront this presumed traitor. Another man may have panicked. Over the previous 6 months, Felt had been meeting secretly with Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, helping him and fellow Post reporter Carl Bernstein with a series of sensational scoops about the abuse of presidential power. But the former World War II spy master had an exquisite sense of how to play the bureaucratic game. In a February 21, 1973 FBI memo, Felt denounced the Post stories as an amalgam of fiction and half-truths, combined with some genuine information from sources either in the FBI or the Department of Justice. To deflect attention from himself, he ordered an investigation into the latest leak. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me today is... now a podcast host herself, which is very exciting. She's my very good friend. She's a self-professed movie encyclopedia. She's also a 3 times national award-winning scribe. Her podcast, Watch With Jen, is now on all of the good podcast apps. So all you need to do, if you want right now even, to pause this show and use whatever podcast app you're doing and type in Watch With Jen. It is my very, very insightful, incredibly prolific viewer and writer. That's especially viewer is my great guest today, talking to me on All the President's Minutes. It's Jen Johans. Jen, thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Thank you so much. What a lovely introduction. Oh my gosh. I'm trying to get on iTunes. Hopefully by the time this airs, I'll be on there.
Look, I can tell you that most folks still do the old iTunes because it's very convenient, but Apple Podcast app is, let's talk inside podcasts and inside baseball, so to speak, right now. Apple Podcast app sucks. It's a really annoying app, and so many people use things like
bummer.
Use Overcast and Pocket Cast and now Spotify. So Spotify, go on there right now. You can find Jen. That's probably the easiest place to find her right now if you want to check out the show. And it's so cool that you are having a litany of awesome people on there to talk to you about what they're watching and what you're watching, and about writing and craft. My favorite episode so far is the Jordan Harper episode, probably because I'm biased, being a lover of Jordan Harper's, both writing and as a person. So that was a lot of fun. It's awesome to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. I love being here, and it's been great getting to know so many people through the One Heat family, like Jordan Harper. And as soon as we clicked, we immediately started talking about our good friend Blake. So, yeah.
Listen, if my life's work is connecting people who love Heat so deeply together and making it this wide group, which I now am going to call the One Heat family, because it's very cool and dubbed by you. So as that, I'm all good. I'm very happy. So let's get started. Firstly, you're obviously a movie fan, and a prolific viewer, and we just quickly talked off air. We touched on your love of Pacula. I think that's, you know, we're in now. We're right in one of the most important moments of the film. The beginnings of the deep throat scene. It's the 39th mm-hmm. minute. It's such a powerful minute. So I think it speaks so much to itself. But I'd love to hear you, Jen, talk about your love of Pacula and his other work, because I think that's something that it's so nice to hear straight off the bat that people love him and are familiar with him, because I think that a lot of the movie folk that I speak to in this show do have a real affection for Pakula as a filmmaker, whereas like some of the journalists and the more historians and craftspeople do mention him, but it's like I loved that you mentioned it first. So I think we should start there.
I am a huge fan of Alan J. Pakula. I actually bought the book, Alan J. Pakula, His Films and His Life, like a couple years back, because I was thinking of writing something on both his work and Sidney Pollack, who's yes. another one of my favorites. I actually credit Sidney Pollack for my existence because my parents on their first date saw Jeremiah Johnson and my mom like didn't want to go. She wasn't sure about my dad. And I always joke, like, if they'd gone to some horrible movie, they might not have had anything to talk about. So Sidney Pollack, and I always kind of link those two filmmakers together. I think their work in the 70s is...
So that Jeremiah Johnson gif must just mean so much more to you than the entire internet who uses the...
It really does.
It must just warm yeah. your heart.
Yeah. It's like, oh, my parents saw that together. Yes. Boy, Pakula, for this podcast, I actually rewatched All the President's Men twice because you got to bring your A game for Blake. And also today I watched The Pelican Brief again.
Underrated.
Which I think so. That was the one Grisham book I remember reading as a kid that I actually stayed up all night till like 3 a.m. reading. And I loved the movies. I was thinking about back then how gifted we were to have like Tom Cruise and Denzel Washington in these Grisham movies. Today they'd be like Amazon series.
Yes.
There would never be, because there's no superheroes or anything like that. So it wouldn't be a big box office success, or even I don't think it would get greenlit.
No, big filmmakers yeah. too, right? So like you're looking at the
yeah.
is it Coppola?
Sidney does Pollack.
Sidney Pollack and then Coppola does one. Am I wrong about that? Which one does he do? Is that
he did The Rainmaker, which is also underrated.
Underrated, yep. Yeah. So it's like you get a Coppola courtroom drama, like The Rainmaker. You get The Firm, and then you get The Pelican Brief, and it's like all of those are these pulpy novels that are consumed religiously. The Simpsons joke about it that every bookshop is, you know, Crichton and King, but it's the same. It's the same sort of gist of the Grishams.
Yeah.
He's in the same wheelhouse. But yeah, no, it would be unconscionable that these would be individual entities, because you just know that people automatically think of like, how can I make the Grisham cinematic universe or the character cinematic universe out of this? You know, everything is cinematic universe.
Yeah.
But it's nice that this was just a standalone.
It was. And all three of those filmmakers made such thoughtful, interesting, the paranoid thrillers in the 70s.
Yes.
And takes us right back to this. My first experience with All the President's Men, I was probably 15 at a youth journalism conference at the University of Minnesota. And there was a presentation on Woodward and Bernstein and how the film, especially, of course, the book too, but was responsible for such a surge in admissions to journalism school.
Yes.
And they had this chart of like, you know, how many people flooded into journalism school after that. And I thought that was so cool. And then, of course, there's the joke that Absence of Malice kind of undid what All the President's Men did, because it showed the danger.
Yes.
But I think you can enjoy it as well and, you know, not drop out of journalism school. But
well, look, I think if you're fickle enough to go into journalism school on a film, you might leave on it. Like, I think if that's your one, and I would say, like, if your one thing for going into the Air Force was Top Gun, you know, maybe you would leave for another, perhaps not nice Air Force film. Maybe Air Force One. I don't know what the anti Top Gun is in the market, but it's like, it seems really strange. But no, it's completely unsurprising, right? Because also then they're lionized, not only in the novel, but as particularly in the film. And I think we will probably get into parts of our discussion talking more about the arc, right? Because it's not, they're not just these supreme beings that come in there. I think it's that process of them elevating up. But it's really interesting, though, you bring up a point that hasn't been brought up yet on the show. It's like all three of those big filmmakers who made really prescient, current, timely paranoia thrillers at the time of the paranoia thriller era. So you get Pacula, who made his trilogy, and then he sort of does little dalliances with sort of semi-paranoia thrillers, but they've got different means. One is sort of like a justice system and judicial. This one is another kind of criminal justice conspiracy. Coppola does Conversation, which is maybe one of the greatest movies of all time in American cinema, but also one of the great paranoia thrillers. So, but they all did them later. And so what's interesting is how there's a commodification, right? Because at the time, all their films that they're making are really out there for the times. Mm-hmm. I mean, All the Presidents is probably the most lauded alongside The Conversation because they both get nominated for Oscar. But then later, these other ones are like popcorn films in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, they all kind of did back in the time. Yeah. It was like paranoia thriller, like central at that moment of time. I think we were all, especially in the Vietnam era, they were not trusting the government and then Nixon and all these assassinations in the 60s. So it kind of fed right into this. I also enjoyed, though, Pacula's little forays into other genres after this. They're underrated, but I really enjoyed Starting Over. It's one of my favorite Burt Reynolds movies.
Yes.
I also love Comes a Horseman.
I haven't seen
it. I know most people, it's so good. It was shot by Gordon Willis as well. It's a Jane Fonda Western where I think it's Robard is the lecherous rancher who's trying to like take her land or something. And James Caan is a veteran who helps her out on the farm. Of course, they fall in love and it's a good one. And then also Rollover with Jane Fonda, which, it's, don't think too hard or you'll be able to pull the entire movie apart, but it deals with foreign interest in our banking. So it has this whole paranoid thing going on as well. So I liked those movies too, but they're not All the President's Men, of course. And I also love that he kind of returned to this later on with Pelican Brief. I was watching that today and thinking, boy, there's a second excellent scene with a parking garage.
Yes.
Just like the one that happens in the 39th minute. And I just thought, kind of cyclical. He went right back to it.
Yeah, I think with these guys, it's one of the challenges is when you get so good at a genre, it's like, do you leave it? I even had a chance a long time ago to talk to Quentin Tarantino. He's like, I don't think you can say that you're a Western director unless you made three Westerns. I think it was his thing. It was like, I don't think you can call yourself a director in a genre unless you've made three of them. And so, because this was coming off the back of him having done Django, then doing Hateful Eight as a Western. And at that time he was tinkering with the idea of doing a Western. And although there is so much Western in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I don't know if he'd consider that his third Western, but,
maybe
that could be the case. But, he does a paranoia trilogy, but I think with All the Presidents, there's a real burden that is different. And exactly like you said, like you can use similar motifs, but the burden is unlike with Pelican Brief because you've got the blessing of it being pure fiction and the reins of fiction allowing you to just do whatever the hell you want and adapt it however the hell you want. I'm really interested about how he flexes this motif in the confines of the factual. Like it is, he's saying this is what actually happened, and this is how, or at least how Woodward tells it. This is how it actually happens. But then he gets to play with, all right, in the confines of these spaces where these things happen, this is how I can affect a mood. This is how I can make you feel like things are wrong. This is how I can make you, feel like things are overwhelming. This is how I can use these perpendicular motifs and have a lot of fun. So I think that's a perfect entryway to get into this minute. So Jen is great, as you already have probably heard, but I'm also pleased that I get to burden her with one of the first deep throat minutes of the film. So I'm so
thrilled.
I'm excited. So we're going to watch this minute right now, the 39th minute, along together. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
Stuck. Story is stalled on us. And you thought I'd help? I'll never quote you. I wouldn't quote you even as an anonymous source. I mean, you'd be on deep background. You can trust me, you know that. Come on. Can you tell me what you know?
You tell me what you know.
Hunt worked for Coulson at the White House. Hunt was investigating Kennedy and Chappaquiddick.
That should tell you a lot. What else?
Well, we're beginning to hear a lot about a lawyer creep named Gordon Liddy. Who's...
There it is.
Great minute.
It is good. It is a really good minute.
Yeah.
I love my favorite minute before we jump in, Jen. My favorite part of the minute, rather, is I love the pause for Hal Holbrook's deep throat when he says, you know, you can trust me.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like for a show where we count down the seconds and we look at every single frame and you look at it, I feel like that 10 seconds or whatever it is, 5 seconds of this minute just slows down to like this imperceptible glacial pace where it feels like it hurts how long he doesn't talk. And then he's like, go on. And there's a great...
Yep.
reaction shot from Woodward, like he's waiting to have the beans spilled to him, so to speak. Like he's waiting for this flood of information and he's like, go. He's like, I have to tell you things. I need you to tell me things. Great. It's a great performative piece. It's such a beautifully framed piece. It's a really, really terrific.
It's interesting. I read something years ago. I'm a huge fan of Nora Ephron. And of course, she was dating Carl Bernstein at the time. And she would, I guess, later on tell anyone who asked who she thought it was. And she said she thought one of the reasons that Mark felt trusted Woodward so much is partly because they were both Navy men.
Yes.
And yeah. And so they'd also kind of had a bond from that. And he'd been a source before. But she always claimed, like, no, Bernstein never told me, and I just figured it out. I also found it was hilarious when their first name for him was My Friend, like Mark Phelps.
Yes.
So I'm glad the editor changed that to Deep Throat. That would have been a little too easy to crack that code.
My Friend. Yeah, for his safety sake, right? Like, let's be really serious. My Friend. Yeah. It's like, I'll quote you as My Friend. I think if Mark Felt would have been like, no. How about no? I might die. You know, this is a big problem.
Yeah. And Hal Holbrook looks so much like him around that time period. It was actually like a little dangerous, I think, that they chose him. But he was so good. One of my favorite things about this minute.
And just to tack onto that, Jen, Woodward insisted on Holbrook.
Yeah.
So the piece of the puzzle is that there are actually a litany of terrific actors who were all, and some huge other names. Obviously, Holbrook was a pretty significant name at the time, but there were huge names that were all in contention. And I'll let you guys do, or Jen may have done some of the half-ass internet research for us as far as who exactly would have been there, because it's a lot of speculation. But there were some other big names in contention, speculatively, that were going to play this role. And it was actually Woodward himself, Bob Woodward, as a consultant, going, he's the best, like, pick him.
Yeah, I know.
The guy who looks most like the guy.
I know. It's like, Woodward, really? But
is it authenticity or like the impulse?
Yeah, it's interesting. But one of my favorite things about this minute was written by or quoted from Steven Soderbergh in this book, Alan J. Pakula, His Films and His Life. He writes or says, in his close-ups, Holbrook's got a light right on his eyes, but it's maybe two stops down at the very edge of perception. And there is another light off to the side that just draws a line right around him, highlighting the side of his face. He looks like a ghost. With Redford, we get skin tones. But with Holbrook, it's just completely monochromatic. Deep Throat is not even human. I love that.
It is great.
Because it's very true. And it's like it becomes a different movie leading up to it. We first get the music score like the minute or two before that. We hadn't had that before. It's late at night. He's walking in a creepy parking garage and it becomes kind of this totally suspenseful movie that is different from just Redford on the phone, you know, sourcing things out.
I love that he points out that light around the eyes because it is imperceptible. And that's the Gordon Willis technique of shooting side lighting on things to you know, cut faces in half because Willis was obsessed with like what lights authentically would do. So like here with this high, you know, fluorescent sort of car park lighting, although there's a lot of the lighting seems to have been taken out for this scene, but like the side light that's on his face very much color matches and feels like it's the light that's also behind him, because he's got the natural light of the car park behind him, the side light and the eye light, but the eye light is so subtle that it's like only now, like in freeze frame, when you're looking at it, you're like, oh my God, that's genius. It must be off way behind the camera in like a weird little spot. And they're doing it in such a low rate, like such a low frequency that it's there. It's really beautiful. And obviously Soderbergh obsessed with this movie too. You know, his film diary is so fun to read because
I love it.
Because there's one of the particular years, I think it was over a couple of years, but it was like 7 or 8 or 9 times in 2 years he'd watch this movie in amongst the litany of other movies that he watches at the same time. And I think that, you know, his where you've got something like The Social Network, which seems like Fincher and Sorkin speaking directly to their mentor, William Goldman, and this movie, I think Soderbergh's Aaron Brockovich is like, has all the tenacity and all the procedure and all the, you know, forthright sort of approach that that Presidents has. I think that, you know, he's kept that in a lot of his style.
And there's a link too with Pacula because it's Julia Roberts who is in Pelican Brief.
Yes.
Yeah. Soderbergh's actually one of my favorite filmmakers. Same. My film school thesis was on Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and I received a scholarship for it. So I've always been obsessed with everything Soderbergh. And yeah, so I was very excited to see him quoted in this book.
How widely available is that, his lives and his films? Is that something that's in print? Because I've been struggling to find some good stuff in Oz, maybe now in the online world, exclusively online world right now, and in the midst of this pandemic as we're recording in April of 2020, if you're listening to this later. Is it still available? Have you seen it around yet?
I bought it used online.
Okay, cool. I'm gonna see if I can find it.
Hopefully you're gonna find it. Yeah, the author is Jared Brown. There's a foreword by Harrison Ford. There's a blurb on the back from Janet Maslin. There's some good Peter Jennings, Meryl Streep. Yeah, it's kind of got the star power going.
I was gonna say. It's got everyone. It's got everyone.
Yeah, I know.
God, speaking as an author, when you're getting that book blurbed, you really, I mean, there's not too many better blurbs and forwards that you could probably approach than that, right?
No, not at all. Yeah, there's 2 full chapters on All the President's Men too. So it's really interesting to see, especially the fighting going on with the script, how William Goldman wrote a jokey version. I found it interesting on this rewatch that I didn't remember this the first time I saw it, but it's really Robert Redford's movie. Yes. And I mean, he is the producer, and it's interesting when you watch it because while Bernstein's, you know, wonderful reporter and very good, he's also kind of painted as more of the antagonistic, whereas Redford is sort of the Dudley Do-Right from Illinois, Wheaton, Illinois. Yeah. Told me Wichita, Kansas or whatever. But I always found that interesting. One thing I also love about it is it's like he's taking the romantic private eye and turning it into this for journalists. So suddenly they're the romantic ones.
Yes.
Which I found very cool.
All the way back to Foreign Correspondent, you know, Hitchcock. The romance.
Oh, I love that movie. Yeah.
The romance where literally a journalist is a detective, like, but a wartime detective. Like, it's the most.
Yeah.
All the lines are blurred there. It, like, breaks all the rules because Hitchcock wants to make a kind of noirish detective movie, but using a journalist as opposed to a detective.
Exactly.
Yeah, it is a. You know, we've talked about in other conversations about a movie where the author or the auteur is so clear, like, and there is an alchemy of cast members and once you've got that preparation, there's a level of trust to go kind of off book and do those sorts of things. But like, it is less clear with Presidents because Goldman kind of unlocked the script and there were different iterations. And then ultimately his final draft of the script is as close to the shooting script as you get, basically. There are like some edits and there's the Efron scene that comes in was Bernstein goes down to Florida, which is basically beat for beat what Efron wrote is kind of integrated into the script, but it's like really one scene in this giant movie. And then when you actually read the script versus how the lines are actually said, there are differences and there's additions and things have been switched, but that all feels very organic to editorial process or like direction or what's organic based on the actors there. So it feels really weird, but you're so right about his author voice in that, like, he's right from the outset, production, engagement with the guys, producing the film, even negotiating to have Hoffman build first, like written first in the film and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's not quite The Towering Inferno, they need the exact same number of lines or any of that nonsense. Or in recent times, they need the same amount of hits in the fight as The Rock and Vin Diesel.
I know, right?
But he had such a place in it. But I kind of really love about this movie how even all the way up to this point, neither of the guys are very good at what they're doing. Like Woodward is very good at talking to people.
Starting out.
Yeah, good at talking to people, but not a very good journalist.
No, he's still learning. What was also interesting, of course, you know, there's so many stories when it comes to the making of this movie, but book talks about Redford and Pacula actually going to, you probably might have read this too, the Madison Hotel and rewriting the script.
Yes.
Taking a month to do it. Yeah. And I found that really interesting. Also, the impetus to make the movie was Redford on his press tour.
Yes.
For the candidate getting mad at journalists not doing enough. And yeah, you can kind of see that. But what I love too with Dustin Hoffman is just the energy is so different. You can tell he has more experience even before he has that sort of expositional line of, I've been doing this since I was 16, just the way he carries himself. And he's always kind of lurking, like he's there in the office.
It's all in the lurk. It's all in this, that cocked head to like, I just want to be listening for an in. Is there something I can get? Is that impulse to sort of sidle up to people?
He's got it.
He's humming on this like manic frequency. He's so cool.
He really is. I know. And while I was doing the research for this for fun, I rewatched Heartburn.
Yes.
Which is based on Efron. Again, I'm obsessed. She and I share a birthday and I think that bonded me when I was little. The first script I owned was When Harry Met Sally. And so I became obsessed with her writing. But I read Heartburn, saw the movie, enjoyed it. But this time around, it was interesting. I was paying attention. For those who don't know, it's about her relationship with Carl Bernstein. They were married and then divorced after he had an affair and their marriage broke up. But even in the fictional version, he's always looking for something he can use. Like she gets robbed at her group and she's in a therapy group and Kevin Spacey actually follows her from a subway and robs the entire group. When she tells Jack Nicholson, who plays Bernstein later, he's like, maybe I can use that for my column. So, and she's like, you can't. That happened to me. So Meryl Streep was so good in it. But it was a Mike Nichols movie. It's very good. But it was funny to see that Carl Bernstein thing just lurking around looking for something to pounce on.
Yeah, and it's also really nice when you're in charge of writing the script of your breakup to really amplify all those qualities you don't potentially like in your ex. Not everyone gets that luxury, but it's like, I think there's that great sort of like tweet level quote of like, don't do anything bad to a writer, we'll describe you. So I think that's a lot of fun.
Very much.
I wonder if Efron's. Oh, sorry to interrupt you. I was just going to say.
I wonder if
Efron's influence was directly on the lines about how good looking and how much he was a Lothario at the time. You know, Bernstein. It's like, oh, my friends have warned me about you. It's like, what did I say? I'm like, I always feel like those lines. Maybe less Goldman, maybe more Efron on there.
Yeah, I heard that scene kind of came from the Bernstein draft.
Yes.
And when, there's a quote somewhere, when Redford read the Bernstein draft, he said, Carl, Errol Flynn is dead. Like, enough. But, there's some great stuff in there. The other thing I didn't know, you probably did, is Redford was asked to play John Clute. So he had almost worked with Bakula before. Mm-hmm. I had no clue. I just can't imagine anyone else in that role. It would have been interesting, but I think Redford's a little too golden boy.
Donald Sutherland brings a quality of desperation that Redford has rarely had in his career. So yeah, like it's one of those things. At that time, it's so hard in that 70s period to not hear of roles where Redford was either asked to do it and he said no, or whether people were like, we want Robert Redford, and he was in some form of negotiation, because it's like everything from Superman to Clute. It's like he really carved the spectrum. Like that whole decade, it was like, we need Robert Redford because
I know
he's the movie star of this decade. And most times it was like, no, he's A, unavailable, or B, he's not right. He's not right for it. And, you know, the studios kept trying to push, and other filmmakers are like, no, we're not casting Robert Redford as Superman. Like, he doesn't look like Superman. It's not happening. So, there are fun ones like that, the litany through the 70s. It's hard to know which ones are blown up or which ones are actually factual in my experience of my research.
I know. Yeah. And, like, he was allegedly in contention for The Godfather, which horrifies me. But...
Yeah.
That would be so wrong.
But, you know, there's other actors that, the other ones is speaking directly about this film, is that Pacino is the other big potential contender for Bernstein. And it's like, yeah, he's got the energy, but is it as manic at that time? I think stillness was really important for him at that time of his career. So it's like, I don't know if it would have worked, but you can totally get that they're like trying to find another big name at that time to sort of sell as like an equal contender to Redford at that time, but couldn't be older, had to be the same age.
Yeah, and a good contrast to their style.
Yes.
I can see Pacino in it. Luckily, he did The Insider so many years later, so he kind of got his own little journalism thing going on.
Yes.
Great movie.
Lowell Bergman.
The other movie that always you can tell its origins are from this is Zodiac.
Yes.
One of my favorite Fincher, actually. So I love how this movie influenced not only people to jump into journalism school, but also that entire generation of filmmakers.
Yes. And Robert, you know, it's funny. I spoke to Peter Avellino in one of the most recent episodes that we've posted so far, as around the time that Jen and I are recording. And Peter, in writing about All the President's Men, quoted Vincent Canby's original review, which he said it's like All the President's Men is the thinking man's Jaws, is what an original review from like 1976 said. And at the time, Roger Ebert wasn't as big a fan of this film, but I think it grew with him when he first saw Zodiac. He's like, this film is like and All the President's Men. He's like, his original quote is something like, you know, this is the crime epic equivalent of All the President's Men, in that like it's the pursuit and the agony of like grinding through every new investigative lead to try and get to some kind of resolution, obviously in a much more bleak way and a lack of resolution, even though the film has a definite, you know, it lands on Graysmith's man, so to speak. But yeah, you know, the connections between those two things, even from down to the fact that Shire scored Zodiac for Fincher and, mm-hmm. and Goldman is still alive and watching the film and all that sort of stuff. And he's consulting with people like Soderbergh to watch Zodiac with him. That was a little bit of a tidbit that I heard from Brian Koppelman, because Koppelman and Levine were working with Soderbergh at the time that Fincher was filming Zodiac, and he asked Soderbergh to come watch it. So yeah, all the connections are there, that these films are both unintentional but very intentional kindred spirits.
Very much. Yeah, and you can definitely see it.
You can see it all there. What do you think about this, the way that this exchange flows? When you're looking at performances in the 70s in paranoia cinema and particularly Redford in this moment, like where are you seeing the influences before this, Jen, and where are you seeing it after? Because I just wonder, someone who's seen so many films and has like got a familiarity with genre, like when you're looking at Redford here and when you're looking at Hal Holbrook's Deep Throat, like are you seeing other relationships that we've seen in noirish movies or detective stories before, like in their exchange?
That's a really good question. I guess I'd have to give that a little bit more thought. Yeah. But the thing I do appreciate about their first exchange is what you were saying earlier about Woodward kind of just starting out. He'd been on the paper 9 months, and you can kind of see his hesitation a little bit. Like, also, we'd only seen him on the phone pretty much. Yes. He wasn't really a living room guy like Bernstein, you know, drinking all the coffee, and he's great. But it was interesting to see the way that Woodward was trying to adapt to this new environment. And I like, by the end of it, he finally gets upset with the cryptic.
Yes.
And, you know, like, tell me. Yes. And I think that was the Bernstein influence.
Yes. Yeah.
So it was nice to see the way that his character arc evolved through the whole movie.
And also there's one thing in this scene, which I think is great. Cause later on they seem to always, and this is the Bernstein influence too, like they almost trip over one another to ask the follow-up question, because sometimes people say something and then they'll jump in to give the follow-up to really clarify something or solidify something in their mind. And so he's like, tell me what you know. And so in the minute in question, the minute we're talking about,
I'm stuck.
He works at Colson & Lice, and he's like, that should tell you a lot. And it hangs there for a second, for a beat, and then it goes. And it feels like
he wasn't sure how far. Yeah.
The later exchanges, he would never let that slide. He's like, what do you, like, he would have said, what does that mean? What do you mean that should tell me a lot? Like, you know, and it's in this moment when he's unsure of what this system needs to look like, of how they will pass information to one another, especially because now, like, it's no longer candor. He can't just ask him a question. He's got to like cryptically confirm and be steered into a direction as the later minutes in this exchange will sort of solidify. But it's one of those things where it's like he doesn't probe beyond too far. He can't. He won't be allowed to just yet. It's like he'll bump against it, and then that's it. He can't say anymore.
Very true. I think he learns, his instincts grow. I also love the relationship with Ben Bradley.
Yes.
And how much that informs his role and growth as a journalist as well. One of my favorite lines in the entire movie, I have two favorites, is the thing that he says to Bernstein, like, I don't mind what you did, I mind the way you did it. I've used that so many times, perfect. And then the one that, just how good is Robards, first of all.
Number one.
But I love the little grin on his face and the beat. This movie has so many interesting beats in the middle of sentences, the pauses, that psychological thing we see a lot in Pakula's movie. He kind of punches on that. But Robards later, like, I don't care where he said.
Yeah, what you said in Salisbury. I care what you admitted to. That's exactly the instinct. That line reading, what you're talking about, is exactly what is missing from this moment. And I think that that's good
exactly
with both of them. And, you were just talking about, you've also talked about a few times that great, you know, that experience of you being at a journalism conference and it showing off there. But his learning from Bradley happens in, you know, only minutes earlier, where he's like, we don't have it. And he sort of gets the lesson faster than Carl, because maybe Carl's experience in them for so much longer is like, oh, I've seen egos, I've seen how people operate. Like, this guy doesn't know exactly what he's talking about, or he doesn't know everything. And the great complimentary impulse of Woodward in that scene is like, no, we don't have it. Why are we bitching about it? We just don't have it. And it's actually that lesson, that influence from Bradley in that moment, where he's like, no, I've got to go to my big internal source for that moment. Can I ask, when you were in that like journalism conference, and maybe this will sort of help tease out the details, like the figure of Deep Throat, this is before anyone knows who he is. Let's just go back to this, before anyone knows who he is, and even though Efron's like, oh, it was him, I guessed. Like, as a figure at that time, and you were watching it as a journalist, like, how much was the emphasis on the importance on sources at that time? Like, as in sources who could, like, was it like the hinge of everything that was being discussed? Like, that a source, you know, the key to a great story is a source that's this big?
Really, it was just talking about the integrity and how you have to be willing to go to jail to protect the source.
Yes.
Also, what deep background means, all of the off the record.
Yes.
It was kind of like, I was in high school at the time, so it was more geared towards trying to convince us and inspire us to go into journalism. Very much. But it's funny, then a year later, at 16, I started college and I became a film student. And one of the first movies we watched in film class was Robert Redford's Ordinary People.
Yes.
So it's kind of weird how Redford, you know, inspired the writing side of me and the journalism conference, and then his movie Ordinary People. So Robert Redford, there you go.
he's the face that launched 1,000 ships in Jen Jones' career, like journalism and film at the same time.
And Jeremiah Johnson.
And
yeah,
listen, the connections abound.
Very much.
When you're thinking about this film, I think that one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about in this minute as a film aficionado is particularly, you know, we talked a little bit about the lighting and the mood, but it's like, doesn't this feel like a complete different planet to what we've seen so far in the film when you're talking about the mood of the entire picture? Because that's one thing that I think I always want to come back to is, in people's memory of the film, you think about the newsrooms, you think about those brightly lit scenes, you think about the beautiful, lovely expanse of their recreated Burbank Washington Post and the Library of Congress scene, but also people think about these car parks. But it's like that there's a complementary nature to their contrasts that I think is so quintessentially Pacula. Like, I think that's what he does so well, is like these real tangible, real spaces, but then these other spaces that feel like they're on another planet almost.
Yeah, I also, the memory of the parking garage scene, I thought there was more light.
Yes.
And so watching this, it's like he walks away from the newsroom and, you know, having to change cabs and the long takes were a little bit more imperceptible in the newsroom.
Yes.
Here, you really feel that long walk over to Deep Throat, or the long car ride that he takes you on. Nowadays, they would probably cut it and he'd be there in 2 seconds, but you really feel it here. And it's like, he left that world and went into like a big fast-paced thriller or even a horror movie, because we're not sure what's lurking right around the corner there.
No, the power of a little, the flick of the lighter to warn him. But yeah, like I think those long takes, there's so much information that's being passed through, like in those newsrooms and in the courtrooms and in the Library of Congress scenes, even so much information. So there's these yawning gaps between, you know, score and what is imperceptible and then experience, like walking across a street or walking down into the bowels of this thing just so slowly to eke out and like, and take you away from like such a, like a relentless pace. Like we're now like essentially 40 minutes into the movie and you're like, it just has not even breathed yet. It doesn't feel like you've had a moment to catch up. It's gone past so quickly. And then you get to this moment, mm-hmm. actually feels like, oh, this is a big moody moment that I need to be. I really am like, I need to sort of find myself.
You breathe.
Yeah. You're breathing. Yeah. You're breathing in this moment.
Yeah. The other thing, and you just inspired, it made me think about it in an interesting way with the flick of the lighter, how all of the rest of the movie, I should say, has so much information packed into it. It's confusing as hell. Like you're watching it and there's too many names and you're like, okay, Segretti is who now? You know, you're trying to put them all together, but it slows it down. All of a sudden that information kind of, you get a little reprieve from so much being fired at you. And it takes it back to old film noir tactics.
Yes.
Like a little shadow and the flick of the light. I mean, that could be Humphrey Bogart. We don't know. So it's very cool when it's Hal Holbrook.
A great fantasy casting of David Thoreau. And extremely, yes, and exactly. Extremely distracting if that was the case, but very good.
Yeah, and he doesn't look like Mark Felt, so it would have hit his identity. No, just kidding.
Better than my friend, that's for sure. That's sure.
Yes.
But yeah, this is where it like really becomes, you know, leans into that noirish feeling. But for me, I just look at I look at it and try and sort of track that when films do something so different like this, it sort of organically feels like it gets into that moment. But at the same time, it is, if you, when you watch it in isolation, sometimes it feels like it's on a different planet to a newsroom scene, because the newsroom scene is so vibrant, there's so much happening, so many different faces and people and textures and books and mess, all the good mess of the mise-en-scene. It's like, it's all so wonderful. And then you get here and it's like this dark.
Yes.
Gross.
Like, did the production designer go home? Like, what's going on? But yeah.
Did they go home? Yeah,
did they forget the lighting guy?
Did the entire lighting department go on strike today?
Yeah.
That can be said of all Gordon Willis movies. But it's just that great texture, that great moment. Now, I have to ask, you've seen this, you said you saw it when you were 16, Robert Redford obviously means so much to the life of Jen Johans. We were learning now, I love the secret history of Jen Johans and Robert Redford. As emerging.
Another Robert, not De Niro this time. You're always getting the Robert.
All the Bob. Oh, well, we affectionately call him Bobby we have that relationship. How often do you go back to journalism movies? Like, are you a bit of a fiend for them, or do they just sort of sprinkle through because you've had past experience learning about it and then flicked into that filmmaking, film studies flex? Like, where are journalism movies and how often do you revisit them in your life?
I find myself just drawn to movies about creative people.
Yes.
Highly verbal people, artists, musicians, like Almost Famous, which is a journalism movie, but also a music movie. I kind of relate to the younger character of that, and Ione Skye in Say Anything. So yes. Those are like, if you put those together, that's me. But I love all of the movies about writers. Wonder Boys is a favorite.
Great.
Journalism movies, probably don't watch quite as much just because there's so much fact-based information. Like, I think over the weekend, you probably saw my tweet. I think you did. I contacted you with it. I found The Insider.
Yes.
I don't think I had seen it since we bought the DVD, probably back in 99 or 2000. So I don't watch these as much. I do watch Zodiac an awful lot just because it's so fun. And it kind of is the parking garage scene, but like expanded for the entire film, basically. Yeah. But, and I think I watch Pelican Brief a little bit more. I do watch all the President's Men probably every few years.
Yes.
So I can't absorb that much information that quickly, which is why I watched it twice this week, because I wanted to make sure I was keeping all the names straight. Yes, have to bring your A game for Blake. So, you know what you're doing with it.
I love how you talk about Zodiac being fun. That's just so fun to hear people talk about that, which is a dark movie, but it is fun. Mm-hmm. It is definitely fun. It's the first mention of Almost Famous, which is such a great journalism movie, but it's just it's a music journalism movie. It's the music journal. It's the All the President's Men of music journalism movies. There should be cancel the rest. It's the best one.
Yeah. yeah, enough of the other one, like where they go out looking for the rock star that might be hiding or something. One of those. No, yeah. This is Cameron Crowe's life. So I love that. Yeah. It's the ultimate coming of age movie.
Yes.
Ultimate journalism. You could approach it from a lot of different angles. I think that's why I watch that one all the time. And also Zodiac, because you can watch it, you know, as a fan of a number of different things put together. All the President's Men is a masterpiece, but you have to be ready to go on this journey. Remember all the names. It's kind of like, I remember growing up seeing my mom take notes during Twin Peaks. When she first saw the pilot, she was trying to, she's one of those people who can watch a mystery and know like who it is right away. And Twin Peaks just fascinated her. So she watched the premiere twice. I was on the floor as a kid watching it with her. She's like taking notes. Okay, Jay is under the fingernail and this is that. And yeah. And so All the President's Men is kind of like that. You're ready to take some notes. Like, okay, Gordon Liddy is just like when Robert Redford
works at the CIA. And yeah, okay.
Yes. And Redford has to ask who the special counsel was. It is.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, we're going to fire Charles you Carlson? For being so dumb. Charles Coulson. Yes.
I'm lucky. I'm so lucky that you asked me that. Because if you asked Bradley or Simons that, I would have fired you and said, "Who's this guy for being so dumb?"
Yes.
A great scene. Another awesome delivery
of a line by Robart.
One of the great pep talk scenes of all time. Well, look, I thank you so much for coming down to this dark garage with me. Thank you so much for joining me for another podcast. I'm so glad that the One Heat family continues to bloom into other podcasting endeavors. So thank you so much for that. And the secret history of your relationship with another Robert, not a Bobby, but another Robert is so fun. And I will definitely make sure I carefully use the Jeremiah Johnson GIF with you from now on. Jen Johans, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thank you so much, Blake. This was a blast. You have a good one.
That was my incredible guest, Jen Johans. You can find Jen at Film Intuition on Twitter and also go to filmintuition.com. Her podcast, Watch with Jen, which I may be on by the time you listen. I'm not sure if it's going to line up right, but look, she's absolutely terrific. She's a very sharp film mind and just naturally incredibly studious. And so she always comes with so many great insights about any films that she discusses. A worthwhile follow and definitely a worthwhile listen to. Jen, thank you so much for being a part of the show once again. Guys, thank you so much for listening to One Heat Minute Productions. Wow, we are at the very end of Josie and the Podcats. 12 episodes. Started at 6, but it's 12 episodes of a ripping series. The 2001 cult classic Josie and the Pussycats. How it began, the history of the characters, all the way through to its enduring legacy with host Maria Lewis. This week, we kick off a very, very special new show, a video and audio podcast, Miami Nice, which you can hear in this thread. It is season 7 on One Heat Minute Productions. You can also catch Increment Vice, which this week has a huge episode with The Last Jedi, Brick and Looper's Rian Johnson. Ooh boy, it's good. You got to check that bad boy out. And of course, All the President's Minutes. If you're listening this week, we have another huge week for you. We have obviously Peter Ryan, Daniel Lamin, Jen Johans, Jason Bailey, many more incredible guests coming along on this show. If you want to support us, there is a link to support us in the show notes of this show to donate just as a one-off cash donation. You can also become a patron on Patreon with a couple of bonus features there and more bonus features coming onto there as well. Guys, thank you so much for your support. If you can't at this time, I know COVID-19 is insane. If you can't support us directly like that monetarily, just a share, a retweet, a share on the Facebook, letting your friends know. Absolutely appreciate everything you're doing. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you on another episode from the One Heat Minute Production Stable soon.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.